Eugene Peterson created a version of the Bible called The Message. And it's not a translation. Steve's probably listening, so he'll come on me if I say it is a translation. It's not a translation, it's a paraphrase. But I enjoy it. I like The Message. And at the beginning of every book, he has an introduction to the book. And let me just read what he writes as introduction to the book of Hebrews. It seems odd to have to say so, but too much religion is a bad thing. We can't get too much of God, can't get too much of faith and obedience, can't get too much of love and worship, but religion, the well-intentioned efforts we make to get it together for God, can very well get in the way of what God is doing for us. More often than not, we become impatiently self-important along the way. We decide to improve matters. We add on. We supplement. We embellish. But instead of improving on the purity and simplicity of Jesus, we dilute the purity. We clutter the simplicity. We become fussily religious or anxiously religious. We get in the way. And I must read that passage, that little text, all of the time. Every couple of months I open it up again and I read it. Because it reminds me of something. It reminds me that if you want to meet the one who said, I am the way, the number one thing you have to do is get yourself out of the way. If you want to meet the one who said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, the most important thing is to get you out of the way. When Jesus talked, he talked incessantly about a kingdom, a supernatural reality, God breaking into the world in an invisible yet powerful and eternal way. And God himself, he said, was planning and he's establishing his rule. And interacting with God was not about going through rituals or about wearing the right clothes or walking around the place like a slap bottom or fasting or eating the right foods. It was about meeting him and being changed deep down in the center of your being. That's what it means to be the kingdom. You come into the presence of God and you meet God not as somebody who's way out there, but you meet him as somebody who's right here, right now. And when you meet him, he changes you. You're transformed in the inner part of your person. And these Beatitudes that we're working through, they're not the way you come to meet God. They are who you are when you have met God. So you come poor in spirit. You come with absolutely nothing. You come mourning. You come sorry for your sin. You come meek. You leave your own agenda at the door. You come hungry and thirsty for change. You come merciful. You show mercy to people because you've received mercy. And it's not a potluck thing. You can't say, well, I'm meek, so I don't have to be merciful. You can't say, well, I have hunger and thirst for righteousness, so I don't have to be poor in spirit. No, we are all growing in these areas if we're in the kingdom. If you come into the kingdom, you immediately start growing in all of those areas. And many of these Beatitudes are about how we relate to our society and to people around us, but the majority of them are about who we are in the center of our being. They're about who we are deep, deep down and what we really want and what we really desire and what we really hunger. There's a compulsion that we have. If you get a compass, you look at the compass will always point north. And I know that in our hearts, there is a compulsion and desire for self-preservation. But what we've done with that desire for self-preservation is we've perverted it. We've expanded it. And it's become a self-obsession, a morbid self-obsession. And we as a generation are the most morbidly self-obsessed people this world has ever seen. We living in the West are the most morbidly self-absorbed people that the world will ever know. 100 years ago, people, they wouldn't recognize us. They would look at us and they'd be amazed. We're the me generation. All that matters is my happiness. Everything is judged on the basis of, will this make me happy? I create my own identity. I pick and choose who I'm going to be. I'm the one who decides what's best for me. I'm the master of my own destiny. Our generation has lost faith in priests and politicians. This morning before I came out, I was just watching 10 minutes of this World War II thing in color. And I taped it last night. I was watching it. And I saw, you know, hundreds of thousands of people all marching to the same beat. Try doing that today. Try to get 100,000 people in Bristol to march to the same beat. Everybody say, no, this is my beat. And you can march to your beat, and I will march this way. And this is the way we are, aren't we? We're all living life on the basis of what we, and only we, decide is appropriate. I trust me, I trust my own instincts, I trust my own understanding. And that works fine if you're buying a coat or a pair of shoes. But if you come into the kingdom, and if you relate to the king, you're suddenly in trouble. Because the king isn't like that. He's omnipresent. He's everywhere. He's omnipotent. He can do anything. He's omniscient. He knows everything. He's eternal. He's from everlasting to everlasting. He's immutable. He never changes. And God, 3,500 years ago, established 10 commandments, 10 rules, 10 laws. And he never walked away from them. He never said, okay, well, they're no longer relevant. They are relevant. And the first one is this: don't have any other gods apart from me. And the second one sounds surprisingly like the first one. Do not make for yourself any image or bow down to it. Don't make an image and bow down to it. Now, when these laws were given 3,500 years ago, what people did often was that they understood that there was a God and that he had high standards. And because he had high standards, it was more comfortable for them to interact with lesser deities, people like Baal and so on. And so a Baal or one of these lesser gods, they didn't care how you lived. They didn't care about your morality. As long as you sacrificed an animal or maybe your child, they'd give you fertility, whether it be in your bed or in your field. And they worshipped these gods because it was easy. It was very clear. I do this and you give me that. It was all a very clear, laid out standard. And what people did was they broke the second commandment. They worshipped the God, but at the same time they were worshipping these lesser deities. And of all the commandments that you and I break, I think the one we break the most is the second commandment. Don't have any other gods before me. Right now we're worshipping here. Maybe an hour from now we'll be worshipping at Cabot Circus. What we do is we worship the wrong things. By worship I mean we set apart as special and holy that which is mundane. We set apart as important. We venerate that which was not intended to be venerated. So a girl who's, I don't know, on the computer for 20 times a day, looking at her Facebook page, saying, is somebody noticing me? Is somebody noticing me? They're worshipping. A young adult who is living desperately for romantic love, they're worshipping. Middle-aged man who spends his whole life in the office is worshipping. And worship is about us staying in control. Our worship is us trying to take control of our lives. And we protect ourselves and we want to maintain control by projecting onto something else our hopes and desires. An idol is something that we take, which is important and good, but we treat it as best. We take something which is legitimate, and we make it ultimate. And we take something which is a normal part of our life, and we say, okay, this is what is going to rule everything. So people whose idolatry is about people loving them, if they're not feeling loved, life loses meaning. People whose idol is to maintain control, if they lose control, their life loses meaning. Now, the Old Testament, when it talks about interacting with God, and it talks about a pure heart, because that's our beatitude for the day. Blessed are those who are pure in heart, for they shall see God. When the Bible talks about people who are pure in heart, it always, always talks about purity in terms of being pure from idols. A heart which is pure is first and foremost a heart which is pure from idols. Because you see, behind that, all the worship of the shopper and the clubber, and even of the Christian, there's a worship that is even deeper. There's a worship of self. What we're worshipping is us, ourselves. When the Ten Commandments were given, people saw themselves in corporate terms. They wouldn't say they were individuals. They would say, well, I'm part of this clan, I'm part of that tribe, I'm part of that nation. But 2,000 years ago, the Apostle Paul was writing his final letter, 2 Timothy. I want you to just turn up, look it up with me. 2 Timothy chapter 3. I'll find the page in a minute. 885. Paul was writing to Timothy, and he says this, 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. But mark this, there will be terrible times in the last days. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not lovers of the good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. Having a form of godliness but denying its power. Who's he describing? He's not describing the people of his own time. He's talking about us. He's talking about you, and he's talking about me. He's looking forward into the future, and he is appalled. He says, in the last days, there will come a people who are like this. First and foremost, lovers of themselves. Worshipping themselves all the time. They make their money their goal. They're arrogant, they abuse others, and they despise their parents. They're not grateful, they are betrayers, they are unrealistic about their own importance and abilities, and they love pleasure and they don't love God. And that's why we pervert sex, that's why we crave money and possessions, that's what causes conflict, that's what destroys relationships. The state of the heart determines the behavior. You know what that means? That our generation has a religiosity, but no understanding of power. We have a form of godliness, but we have no experience of the power of God. And just like those people who worshipped a statue in the Old Testament, who missed out on the power of God, we are missing out on the power of God because of our idolatry, because of who we are and who we worship. Our grinding, morbid self-obsession is killing us. It's killing me and it's killing you. 25 years ago, I was doing an outreach here in Broadmead, and I said to a girl about worshiping God, and she said to me, well, you know, that's interesting, but why doesn't God worship me? And I was shocked. But now I see that this is what we're saying all the time. Why doesn't God worship me? Why should I worship God? And we come to God, and people come to God, but we come to God in our self-obsessed way. We come to God in a way that breaks the second commandment. And there are some who are passing judgment on God, and they say, I can't accept a God who doesn't dot, dot, dot. I don't know. Whatever they're concerned about. Babies dying, global warming, their football team not doing very well. And they say, I can't accept a God who is not actively, visibly to my eyes, dealing with the things that I care about. Have you heard that? Others say they want to evaluate God. They want to do a performance management study on him. I will come and worship God if he gives me something that will work for me. He gives me something that will work for me, and then I'll worship him. Others worship God, but they really want to feel good about themselves. And they're like the guy who's working in the office, but they're working in a church. And they're rushing around doing lots of good things. But what they want is a pat on the back. What they want is that someone say, oh, you're really brilliant. Well done. Well done. I remember once I said to this guy, oh, you know, I've done this and that and the other. He said, get your arm, put it up high, drop it down in the back, and pat yourself on the back. And I thought, yeah, that's why I'm telling you all this. I'm looking for a pat on the back. Some people want to have some kind of deal with God. And they say, okay, I'll go to church and I'll be good and I'll evangelize and I'll do all those things, but you give me what I really want. I'll do all these things for you, but you do what for me, what I want. Can I tell you, all of those things are idolatry. We are worshiping ourselves. Any kind of action for God that has any kind of motivation, like what I've just described, is basically self-worship. It is a form of godliness, but has no understanding of power. It's all about our heart. Psalm 24, who may ascend to the hill of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place? He who has a clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to an idol, or swear by what is false. Jeremiah said, the heart is deceitful above all things, and desperately wicked. A deceitful heart pretends one thing with the actions, but it desires another thing in the heart. A deceitful heart does one thing, but its desire is somewhere else. Now listen, how would you feel if I wanted to be your friend to get something off of you? How would you feel if someone said, I want to be your friend, but really what they want is something else? How do you feel when someone hurts you and uses you? I know how I feel. I feel hurt and angry. I feel hurt and angry when someone uses me. Well, that's how God feels, hurt and angry. His plan is not to explain himself to us. He's not going to explain himself to us. His plan is not to give us something that will work for us. His plan is not to get us noticed by other people. His plan is not to cut some kind of deal with you. And if you do this for him, he'll do that for you. The bottom line is that people are going to hell. People are going to hell. And God's plan is to stop them going. People are going to hell. And his plan is to change that reality. But to get him, to really get him, you have to have a pure heart. It's emphatic, isn't it, this passage? Blessed are those, blessed are the pure in heart, for they and they alone, is the Greek. For they and they alone will see God. Now let me ask you this. Do you have a pure heart? Do you have a pure heart right now? Is your heart pure? It's a dangerous question, isn't it? Examining our motives. It's a bit like Alice in Wonderland. You go down the rabbit hole. And it starts getting really surreal really quickly. And as you start to unpack your motivations and as you start to understand why you're doing things, you're peeling away layers of arrogance and pride and self-centeredness. And what happens is you start to understand that you keep peeling away. And pretty soon you get the nasty suspicion that there isn't a pure heart under all the layers. That under all of the layers, we don't have a pure heart. They're actually rotten to the core. And then you realize that what you need is for God not only to give you a pure heart, but to peel away the layers of our unpure heart, and then to help us to know him. We need him for everything. We need him to give us the strength to peel away the layers, but we need him also to put a pure heart within us. And this is his plan. This is a plan for you and for me. The one who loved you from the foundation of the universe. The one who knows your name. The one who knows all about you. He created you for himself. And he's brought you on a difficult road. And I know he has. He's brought you on a very long and difficult road. He's brought you through a lot of situations that you've struggled with. And why is he doing that? He's doing it to purify your heart. He's doing it to give you a pure heart. He's doing it to disengage you and disentangle you from all of the self-centered devotion to other goals. He's brought you on this long, dark road to bring you to a point where you say, actually, all I want is you. All I want is your glory. How do you come into that? Don't throw up your hands. Having a pure heart is a process. It's a process. Someone who is in the process of getting a pure heart, with God's help, is identifying the idols in their lives and ditching them. God is speaking to them. Why do we say read the Bible and pray every day? Because when you read the Bible and pray every day, you get before God, in front of his word, and he starts to undress you. And he undresses you. And he shows you who you really are. And once he's shown you who you really are, then you're ready to be made different. A lot of people want to keep God at arm's length. They want to say, listen, I want to come to church and I want to be nice and I want to be a good person, but please don't take over every part of my life. Please don't undress me. Please don't radically transform me. And they want to keep God just at arm's length. And they think they're being clever. And they think they're being wise. But what happens? People who say to God, I don't want you, because that's what you're saying, well, God honors that. And as people go through their lives saying to God, I don't want you to change me, as they come to the end of their life, he says, well, I'll give you what you want. An eternity in the one place I'm not. And people, God doesn't send people to hell. People send themselves to hell. They send themselves to hell by saying, I don't want you. And so he gives them what they've asked for. An eternity without him. And then we know, don't we, that at the gate of the hell, Jesus is standing with his arms stretched out like this. He says, you go to hell over my dead body. You go to hell over my dead body. He died and rose so that we could have a pure heart. The book of Hebrews begins this way. Let me read it for you. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in the last days he's spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory, and the exact representation of his being, sustaining all things by his powerful word. And after he provided purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty in heaven. He has provided all the purification we need. We don't have to purify ourselves. We just have to come to him and ask him to purify us. We don't have to try to change ourselves. We have to come and ask him to change us. Change our motivation, our attitudes. And this alone can satisfy him. Philosopher, psychiatrist in Switzerland, Karl Jaspers, taught his students that there was a moment when you come into utter clarity. There's a moment in every person's life when all the shutters go off and you see things as they really are. And his students, who were very enthusiastic about this idea, thought that it probably came at the point of death. So they started experimenting with cutting off the oxygen and dying and then being coming back to life. I think there was a film called Flatliners was made. And he said, no, we don't know this happens at the point of death. Don't do that. But you and I who are in the kingdom, we don't laugh at that, do we? We don't belittle it. We understand it. Because we know we all need that. The kingdom, coming into the kingdom and seeing God, is that experience. It's a moment of clarity and joy, which makes sense of your life. And as you enter his presence, you become aware that he's there. And you're awestruck by his glory. And you have a direct experience of him. And your breath is taken away. And you enter into his arms the way those Chilean miners entered into the arms of those who loved them. And you're transformed. This is the capstone of human experience. This is it. Seeing God. Experiencing him. There was an old film about a pianist. And he was a great pianist and he was playing the piano and someone attacked him. And when he recovered from the attack, he'd lost his memory. And he spent several years wandering around and he didn't know he was a pianist. But every time he got to a piano, he would feel this sense of longing because he was a great pianist. But it was mixed with fear because he'd been attacked while playing the piano. And then one day he sat down and he overcame his fears and he started playing the piano and suddenly his whole life came together again. This is what it means to see God. Seeing God is the capstone of human existence. Seeing God is everything. And you're afraid. We're afraid to see God. We're afraid to let ourselves be undressed by him. We're afraid to give up our motivations. We think it might annihilate us. But we've got to do it. We've got to stop coming to him and saying, do this for me and I'll do that for you. Or let people notice me. Or I can't trust you. We've got to come to him and say, right, here's my life. The only thing I want to do is see you. The only thing I want to do is experience you. What you want is not more money. What you want is not better friends. What you want is not a better job. You don't want a God who agrees with you. You don't want a God who passes your test. You don't want a God who gives you what you want. What you want is him, the real one, the powerful one. What we need is Him. We need to experience Him. We need to know Him. We need to set aside our agendas and know Him. Because those who are pure in heart and who see God are the ones who are blessed. They're the ones who know blessing.